Daniel chapter 7, page 900. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and the four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Rise, devour much flesh.' After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, and its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. And the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed."
Thanks, Mike. Keep your Bible open there in Daniel chapter 7. And thanks, Conrad, very much indeed for early on encouraging us. The Bible is relevant. It's the same God who's with us today, who inspired the Bible to be written. He's the same God who loves the world. He loves you. He loves me. He's the same God who has a message for us, and he speaks to us through the Bible. So keep your Bible open there as we come to Daniel chapter 7. Let me pray, and let's ask God to help us to understand what he has to say to us relevantly and really for ourselves and our own lives. God our Father, we want to thank you that the Bible is your word, that it is relevant because you still speak to us today through it. Thank you that the promises you made through the written word 2,000 years ago are as relevant to us today as they were 2,000 years ago. Thank you that you love this lost world, that you still speak to this lost world, that you want this lost world, that you want us to hear you, to be encouraged by you, to be warned by you, to respond to you, and to live in a way which means that we can end up living in eternity with you. So help us this evening to understand what you have to say to us through the Bible, and help us to respond appropriately, obediently, and humbly. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. I wonder if there have been times in your life when you felt overwhelmed by the circumstances of life, or just overwhelmed by the way the world is going. Sometimes the world can seem so out of control that things happen around us that we have no control on whatsoever, and we can often find ourselves being forced down a path in life that we really wouldn't rather take ourselves. If it had been up to us, we'd rather things were different. Sometimes life is like that, isn't it? Because the world is bigger than we are, and more powerful than we are, and stronger than we are. And the forces in the world end up pushing us in directions that often we don't want to go in. And maybe that you're facing a situation in life at the moment where you just simply feel overwhelmed just by what life is delivering you. And you think, well, I would love to be in a different place or a different time with different people in different circumstances. I just wish I wasn't right here at this point in time. I'd rather be somewhere else where things would perhaps be a little bit easier for me. It may well be that you've not long chosen to be a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ, and you're just beginning to discover that that isn't always the most comfortable decision to have made. And that when someone said to you in the course of you perhaps choosing to become a Christian, someone said to you, well, look, if you follow Jesus, you're going to have to carry your cross and follow him. And you thought, well, yeah, I take that on board. But now you're just realizing what that means. As people perhaps shun you at work or laugh at you. Someone was just sharing with a group of us this morning how somebody actually scorns them and laughs at them. Because they're interested in their son growing up actually to be a Christian and serious about their son praying. They get laughed at and scorned for that. And you think, well, how can that? Well, that happens. Stuff happens in pleasant English country like we live in Sheffield. Stuff happens. But not just here in this country, in other parts of the world as well. The United Nations Security Council, I've also been to New York, and the pictures coming up on the screen, I unashamedly have been influenced by where I've been over the last week. The United Nations Security Council in the headquarters there in New York has one chief aim, and that is world peace. World peace. That is the big aim of the United Nations Security Council. And you'll see on the picture above my head there, Pete Jackson, who's worked with us for 4 years and hopefully will be returning to us next year, standing there in the heart there of the UN, looking like he owns the show. But slowly, in actual fact, he was coming down with flu, and he wasn't happy for the rest of the week as a result. But there he was, right there at the heart of some big decisions in our world that's gone on in that room. Well, right outside the doors to that chamber is a painting, which is coming up on the screen next. And it's a painting by an artist, a Spanish artist, called Zanatti. And the Zanatti in the painting there, hopefully up on the screen, hopefully you can see a little bit of it. There's an awful lot going on, and it describes the stress, the complexity, the difficulty, the enormity of the UN Security Council. The title of this painting is actually called Human Struggle for Peace. And it's got men with bits of wood as they're trying to build and establish peace. And there's this intricate balance going on where if someone further back up the picture gets their bit wrong, it's going to affect everything, the balance of everything else in the picture. And it just speaks of complexity. It speaks of the enormity of the task. It speaks actually really of the impossibility of the United Nations Council there, the Security Council, really saying what these guys are trying to do is overwhelming. Sometimes in our own personal lives we can feel overwhelmed. I guess there are times that if you were a part of that UN Security Council, you would be overwhelmed. Overwhelmed by the sheer complexity of the world in which we live, and why some people in parts of the world at quite a lot of the time, you know, year after year, just do not want peace. World history is marked, isn't it, with people who are hostile and violent and hungry for power. Overwhelming. a sense of being overwhelmed. Well, Daniel chapter 7 tells us that world history will be marked by the rise again and again of aggressive, of hostile, powerful men and nations who will be overwhelming, who will abuse their power. Just a little bit of a word about the kind of part of the Bible that we're looking at the moment, just before we go on any further. The Bible is made up of all sorts of different kinds of literature. There are letters written to real people in real time by real people. There's poetry. And this particular section of the Bible we're looking at the moment is called apocalyptic literature. It's very similar to the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. That also is apocalyptic literature. And apocalyptic literature is often strange to us. It's got all sorts of imagery in it. It jumps about between what's going on in heaven and what's going on earth. And sometimes there's no clue as to when that's about to happen. It just happens. And it's up to the reader to get with the rhythm of what's going on to see when it's happened. There's all sorts of symbolic numbers. There are symbolic colours. There are dreams and visions of what's going on. But the most important thing, and again with this picture here, it's actually a good illustration. The most important thing about apocalyptic literature, if I can put it this way, is don't get too close. Alright, don't get too close. Like this painting. If you go right up to one little section of Zanetti's painting there, and just looked at that one little section, and try to understand what was going on, you wouldn't get very far. It's such a vast piece of art. You need to stand back and see the whole. You'd get lost looking at a small section trying to work out what the fine details are. There are people who will approach the book of Revelation and other apocalyptic literature and get so close to the detail and try and figure out, well, that is about that person there and this is about that part of history and that's about that nation, and try and make it all, you know, fit in with a particular time in history and get so close to it, actually miss what's going on. You need to take a step back. Look at the big picture. Don't get too close. See what's going on in the whole, and you'll get a handle on what's going on. And I think that's really the right approach here for Daniel chapter 7. And the first thing that I just want to draw out is just the reality of the world in which we live. Verses 1 to 8, it is really about world power abuse. And Daniel 7 is telling us that one of the key features about world history is the rise of men who will abuse their power. In fact, they will be determined to rise themselves in order to get to a position in which to abuse their power. But that will mark world history. And so Daniel has this vision. Look at verse 1. It's in the reign of Belshazzar. Those who have been with this series all the way through will remember Belshazzar from chapter 5, the writing on the wall chap. Belshazzar, if you were here with chapter 5, will remember that he was determinedly anti-God. And Daniel, this is in the context of that particular king's reign. And you imagine Daniel thinking, oh, what's going on here? And other of God's people thinking, well, what is going on? This guy hates God. He really doesn't like God's people. Then into the context of that particular reign, Daniel has this vision, which kind of like tells him things aren't going to get any better. And really the call for Daniel is to be a realist. Not to be sort of a pipe dreamer, but a realist about the world in which we live. And so Daniel, particularly in reference to the first section of his dream, look at verse 15, he talks about being really anxious. And the visions that he saw alarmed him. The truth about the world can be overwhelming. Daniel's dream is about the rise to power of terrifying men. Men who abuse their power. Power corrupts. And we need to be realistic about that. World history will see the rise of rulers like the lion in verse 4. Look at the lion this ruler who's depicted as a lion in verse 4. He's ferocious, he's powerful. This lion has eagle's wings, which kind of like are illustrative of the swiftness that he has. So he's ferocious, he's powerful, and he's as swift as an eagle. There will always be nations and men like that. Verse 5 talks about the rise of a bear. Violent. This military bear. It's gorging itself. Just look at the verse 5 there. It's gorging itself on meat, and it lifts its head from a bloody meal, and it's got bones stuck in its teeth. It's a gory picture, isn't it? But Daniel's been told in his vision that world history will be marked by men who are just like that bear. They will devour people. They will be brutal. And then there's a leopard there in verse 6 whose power is universal. That's one of the things that's said about that particular ruler. Universal, worldwide power. And we've seen that again and again, haven't we? Powers that have influence and affect the whole world. And then in verses 7 to 8, there's this terrifying horned beast, which is indescribably wicked. And this particular beast has a real distaste for God, and a real distaste for God's people. And so verse 21 describes that particular beast a little bit more. As I looked, this horn, there were 10 horns, and a particular horn grows up, and this horn made war with the saints, that is the people of God, and prevailed over them. And then verse 25 described again, he will speak words against the Most High, blasphemous, determinedly anti-God. And then look at the second section there in verse 20, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High. That's, I mean, that's put in quite a visual way, just being worn out by the ruler of the nation. And then the third section there, and shall think to change the times and the law. This is the guy who'll take what God has instituted in the normal order of things and will twist it around and try and reinvent the wheel. Try and remove the way that God has ordered things. Obliterate it. And history is littered with people like this particularly terrifying horned beast of verses 7 to 8. Nero and Stalin. And not long ago, there were two or three of us in the church here. We were in a court case where we heard from an independent legal think tank based in Oxford about the systematic government-sponsored violent persecution of Christians in Iran. It shouldn't surprise us. Christians have and will face hostility. In the United Kingdom, we've not faced persecution from the authorities in recent years, but the picture up on the screen, I hope at the moment, should come up on just there in a moment, it's a picture of Fox's Book of Martyrs. Right? There it is. There's a copy of it here, Fox's Book of Martyrs. This is a book which has played a crucial part in English history. It is a book which describes the persecution and the martyrdom of British Christians. And it describes what happened to them in quite some detail, actually. Quite gory detail. And this is a book which Christians for decades in this country read and gave them steel and backbone to actually stand up to be counted as born-again, Bible-believing Christians. Some of you will remember Mark Gilder sharing a Christian story in our church. This is a couple of years ago now. William Tyndale, who translated the Bible into English. Well, the British government sent out special agents onto the continent who wheedled their way into William Tyndale's little group that met in a pub, his little Gamma team, his fellowship group, his home group, his discipleship group in the pub, got this little special agent in there alongside him and grew to trust him. And basically that was the guy who nabbed him and brought him back, and the guy was put to death for translating the Bible into English. So, British history has had its fair share of persecution. But there are other parts of the world where it still goes on today. And I don't know what the future holds in Britain. I've taken to liking that little phrase, secular fundamentalism. Because fundamentalism is often used of religious people and Christians and people who believe the Bible. You're fundamentalist. Well, it's just great to see that word being turned around and used of people who are basically secular fundamentalists. And secular fundamentalists, they are fundamentalists. They don't have time for the freedom of religion at all. They despise religion. And that is a growing philosophy in our country. And who knows what will happen to Christians in our country in the future. But the call of Daniel 7 is to be realistic. This stuff happens. We shouldn't be sentimentalists. We shouldn't have a false hope. It's interesting that the United Nations General Council was in full swing when we visited it earlier this last week. And we paused just for a moment to listen to what was going on. And the person speaking said this is the exact quote, said, "This organisation, the United Nations, is the embodiment of hope." That's exactly what they said. It was that the United Nations is the embodiment of hope. And I wanted to shout, come outside and look at that guy's painting. And you'll see, you're not. You know, the nations uniting will never be an embodiment of hope because it's the nations that produce the evil men. And will produce the beasts. So it's history tells us to be realists, and I think the Bible here, the Bible warned and encouraged Daniel in his day to be a realist. And the call for us is to be realists, to see the way the world is. Of course, being a realist could so easily lead us to being a fatalist. You know, that's just the way it is, the way it's always been, the way it's always going to be. There's nothing to be done, so let's just live with it. Well, that's fatalism, and being a realist could so easily slip into being a fatalist. If Christians are going to be realists, what is to stop us slipping into fatalism? Well, I think the answer is in the next section there in Daniel's vision, verses 9 to 12. The first section is about the world power abuse. Verses 9 to 12 tell us about God's perfect judgment. God's perfect judgment. Although it may seem that at times the world is not out of control, when it seems that the great powers of the day are the ones that are in control, then these verses 9 to 12 tell the Christian realist not just to be a realist about the world, but to be a realist about God. That God is in control. God is in absolute control over the world. Just cast your eye back to verse 4 and the lion. The lion, that verse 4 tells us that there is a greater power than the lion. The lion is given power by God. Verse 5 tells us that there is a greater power than the bear. Verse 6 tells us that there is a greater power than the leopard. And then verses 9 through 12 tell us that there is a greater power than all of them, and there is a greater power that the evil beast of verses 7 through to 8 will one day face and will be judged and will be killed by. That's what these verses say, that there is a greater power over in authority who will judge the evil of men, and he is the one who rules overall. And it's just striking how Daniel's dream and vision changes. There's a change of scene. It goes from the terrifying, chaotic, brutal, bloodthirsty, sort of disorder, bloody tumult, to verses 9 to 12, where you immediately go into a place of order and calm and peace and security. And dignity that human beings cry out for and crave for. Dignity, the dignity of God and his rule, his right rule over the world is what's depicted there. The purity of the judge stays there in the consuming fire. This describes his holiness, his otherness, his absolute perfection. He is the one who rules over all. So Daniel says, and I looked, and thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 served him. See, the whole world worships him. That's the word there, serve, worship him. And 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And then he judges there in that last section of verse 10. The court sat in judgment and the books were opened. Well, this is what all the beasts are accountable to. Every human being is accountable to the living God. Every thought, every word, every deed. No motive is unknown by God. No inclination unexamined by him. Nothing is overlooked as he opens the books to make his judgments. In verse 11, I looked, then Daniel looks, and because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking, so here's the horn speaking, mouthing off at God, as it were, and Daniel looks, and the beast is killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time, but basically they came to an end. And here's the one who calls a halt to it. He rules. He's the sovereign God. So yeah, be a realist. Be a realist about the world, but don't be a fatalist, because be a realist about God too. Be a realist about the God who rules. He will judge. He, not the United Nations, is the embodiment of hope. That's why Daniel, earlier in the book of Daniel, chose chapter 1 not to defile himself, because this is the God he knew. That's why Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego were able to say to Nebuchadnezzar, our God's able to save us from your fire, but if not, we still won't bow down. Because God is God, he's judge. They knew the reality about God. They were real about the world, but they had the reality, their perspective on God. That's why Daniel in chapter 6 is able, he hears that the document's been signed. You can't pray to anyone except the king. Well, what does he do? He does what he always did. Go straight to his room and prays, because he knows who God is. Pilate, who has sentenced Jesus Christ to death, the Roman ruler, governor, said to Jesus, do you not know that I have authority to crucify you? Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Yeah, you're powerless unless God's given it. That was Jesus' reply. Jesus was real about the world, real about his Father in heaven. Be a realist about the world, but don't be a fatalist. Be a realist about the God who rules the world and will one day judge the world. So Daniel served the living God. And in the context of world power abuse, he was able to be real about it, but he was able to know that God's perfect judgment would one day come. And that helped him to live and to serve the context in which he was. He knew who God was, and he knew that God had ruling over the rulers that ruled him, and he went about his life serving those rulers as he served God. It actually liberated him. It wasn't just so heavenly minded he was so no earthly good. He was heavenly minded and was able to do a lot of earthly good. He went to work each day serving the living God. He loved his leaders. He wanted Nebuchadnezzar to come and understand the living God, even though Nebuchadnezzar was trying to chuck his friends in a furnace. He loved the people that were around him, brutal as they were. As Christians, we're called to be peacemakers. We're called to love and pray for those who persecute us. We're told to work for the good of the nation in which we are, that even though it will despise us. That's the call. That's the call in the book of Jeremiah before all this lot cruised out into exile. They were told by God through the prophet Jeremiah to get into the land, the city where they were, to make their home there and do well for the city, to serve people there. And that's the call upon Christians. to be realist about the world, to be realist about God and who he is. And the third section there, there's real hope in verses 13 and 14, the third section that I just want to draw our minds to, Jesus' eternal reign. The scene changes again in Daniel's vision, and he sees this human being, and the way that the human being described is one like a son of man. And of course, Bible words, Bible phrases have Bible meanings, and the son of man is used in the Bible to describe human beings, like in Psalm 8. You know, a son of man literally means a human being. But we also hear in another psalm, Psalm 80, that son of man was also used to describe God's king over his people. So you see what's going on here. The contrast is well, it's meant, and it's quite clear. Daniel sees these less than human rulers, these dictators, these bloodthirsty, violent, unjust rulers, kind of less than human, beastly rulers. His mind then goes to this vision of God the judge, and God's ruling king, who is the son of man. He's a human being, the perfect human being, nothing beastly about him. He's the perfect human ruler who comes and rules in justice and peace. And under his rule, everything is put right. Now, that's the dream, that's the hope that is before Daniel. That'll always stop him being a fatalist. That gives him faith. In fact, the depiction of heaven in the book of Revelation is a place where the street gates are open. It's a place of peace and security. You can come and go as you want, no fear. A wonderful city to live in. And here is the Son of Man depicted in his eternal glory and in his wonderful rule. There's no less than human about him at all. He's the perfect, just human ruler. But he's not just human, he's also heavenly. He comes, as you see there, on the clouds of heaven. And he does what no ordinary human being can do. He approaches the Ancient of Days. He enters God's presence. And he's given all authority, not just authority over some people. He's given all authority over all nations. He's more than human. He's God. The things that are described, the way he's described, give him that sense of being one with the Ancient of Days. All people everywhere worship him. We know from the Bible you should worship nobody but God. People are worshipping him, serving him. Yes, he's human, but he's heavenly. He's God and man. He is ultimately the uniter of nations. He will be the one who brings people together from all parts of the world under his rule. It's wonderful, isn't it? I saw the night in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him, worship him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Just look again at verse 13, and let me just ask you a question. You might want to just turn very briefly to the person sat next to you and just discuss this little brief question with them. Which direction, what direction is the Son of Man moving in verse 13? Okay then, you've had enough there. Which direction is he moving in? Where's he heading? Where from? He's heading from heaven, is he? Or where? He's going towards the Ancient of Days, isn't he? So he wasn't with the Ancient of Days at the beginning of his little travels in verse 13. He's moving towards the Ancient of Days, isn't he? So the New Testament picks it up. If you've got a pen and a piece of paper, then just write these down. I won't go through them all now because time has moved on. Sometime later on, look at Matthew chapter 26 and verses 63 and 64. That's Jesus in his court case. And he tells those that are trying him, he says, "You will see the Son of Man, Jesus himself, coming on the clouds of heaven." And it talks about him coming away from the Ancient of Days back to earth. Okay? But later on, Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 to 20, you hear Jesus getting his disciples together, and just before he leaves, "All authority," he says, "in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations." Here is the ruler of all the nations saying, "Go and tell other people to learn of me and to submit to me and come into my kingdom." And if you look into the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1 and verses 9 to 11, you get what we call as Christians the ascension of Jesus back into heaven. And what does he leave on? Sorry? Pardon? Clouds, yes, clouds. Clouds are important in all those little texts I gave you. He leaves on clouds to go back to heaven. I think Daniel here is a picture of something that happens. Jesus returning to the Ancient of Days where all authority is given to him. For the whole world, and his authority is demonstrated as the good news of his death and his resurrection and the forgiveness of sins is preached and told to the nations. And that is the way he unites people and draws people into his family. And so we've got three kind of like sections of history. There is the now, which is cruel, the cruel world in which we live, and Christians must be realists about it, but not fatalists, because we look towards a day when God will judge perfectly. And after that day of perfect judgment, he will bring in and usher in the perfect, complete, eternal rule of the Son of Man, the perfect human ruler, who will rule for eternity. And that is the hope that Christians have before them. I just want to end by reading a little bit of my favourite stories, the Narnia stories, because I think Puddle Glum sums it all up really rather well here. I don't know if any of you know the C.S. Lewis stories about Narnia. As a family, we're just reading through them again. And Puddle Glum is in this book, the sixth of the seven books, in the Silver Chair, is one of my favourite characters. Puddle Glum is a realist, okay? And actually borders on being a fatalist and a pessimist as well. And he always assumes that things aren't going to work out well. When he and two children head off to go in search of the lost prince of Narnia, Rillian. And Puddle Glum decides, well, I'd better go. It's going to be a failed journey. We're never going to find him. We'll probably get beaten up and we'll probably die. And it'll do me a lot of good because all the Abermarsh Wiggles think I'm a bit flighty and I need something to kind of like calm me down a little bit. And a failed journey is just what I need. So he kind of like sets off to find the lost prince Rillian. And eventually they discover Rillian deep within the earth, under the spell and the enchantment of an evil green witch, an evil green queen. And she's there in the dark underworld, planning to take a massive great big army to conquer the overworld. The witch has the prince under her enchantment, and she does all this, produces all these nice smells and aromas and perfume from a fire, which generally sort of drowses them into believing everything that she says. And she just basically tells the children and tells Puddle Glum that the overworld is just a dream. This sun you speak about is just a figment of your imagination. The real world's down here, in the dark, in the underworld. This talk about Aslan, the great ruler, the great lion, he doesn't exist. And slowly they get lulled with a smell that's coming from the fire and a soft voice and wooing them. They start to believe that the world, the real world, doesn't exist. A Puddle Glum saves the day. He gets a bit uptight and a bit edgy. He goes over the fire with his flat webbed feet and he stamps it all out and it rather burns him. And he hobbles back to stand with the children, and this is what he says. "One word, ma'am," he says to the queen, coming back from the fire limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been saying is quite right. I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who's always liked to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said, but there's one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all these things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have, then all I can say is that, in that case, the made up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game. And if you're right, but four babies playing a game can make a play world that licks your real world for hollow. And it brightens up the kids and they go, yeah. Now, C.S. Lewis is very clever there. He basically talks about Narnia. Well, Narnia is real. The rule of the Son of Man is real. So let's, as Christians, the call of Daniel is to be realistic about the world in which we live. And that will free us actually to serve the real God in which we live. Being realistic will change your attitude at work tomorrow. It'll change. You'll have no false expectations about your boss, about school, about your colleagues. You'll have no pipe dreams, no sentimental ideology. There won't be a sort of a make-believe world for you tomorrow to go and pretend it might exist one day. No. You won't have any false expectations about making the world a better place. But you won't be a fatalist. You won't be a pessimist, because you'll be a realist about God as well, just like Daniel. You'll go to work tomorrow to serve God with vigour. You'll love your colleagues. You'll give your best to the company that you work for. You'll love your boss. You'll work hard for them, because you know full well that in serving your boss at work, you're serving the King of Heaven. You'll be looking forward to that day of judgment when God says, well done, my good and faithful servant. You see, being a realist changes Monday, right through to Friday and Saturday, right through to next Sunday again. As a realist about the eternal reign of the Son of Man, you'll have a fresh spur to your prayers for your boss, for your colleagues, for your neighbours. You'll have a fresh desire to get them ready to meet the Son of Man themselves when he returns on the clouds of heaven. See, being a realist about the world, and being a realist about God, and being a realist about the Son of Man changes life forever. So my encouragement from Daniel is, be a realist.